न जायते म्रियते वा कदाचिन्नायं भूत्वा भविवा भविता न भूयः अजो नित्यशाश्वतोऽयं पुराणो नान्यते हन्यमाने शरीरे. The self was never born and it never dies. It has not come into being and it will never cease to be. It is birthless, eternal, unchanging and timeless. It is not killed when the body is killed. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Peace Peace. Peace be unto all. Now, this morning you may be expecting to hear a talk on consciousness because it was written in the bulletin that way. Yes. Did anyone come specially to hear that talk?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to turn around and give you 2 minutes to leave. Because unfortunately what happened was, Swami Atmarupanandji was here last week, and I missed his whole visit, but then I came back and found that he would stay till Wednesday, and I had the choice, either I can spend time with him and take him sightseeing and everything, or I can stay back and prepare a new talk. So naturally I chose to spend time with him. So I thought I'd give a talk on a similar topic and save the other one till later, because I have big plans for this other talk. I want to have some presentation and drawings and things. No, seriously, I had this idea in mind. So, yeah. Really? So, I'll be speaking on the topic, remembering who we are. And I don't think I ever gave this talk here. It's an older talk. There's a little story behind it. We had a devotee in California. She was part of a group that met at Leisure World. We had a Leisure World class there. I used to go once a month. Very, very wonderful people. She was especially interesting. This woman, her name was Ellen Rose Miller, and we called her Sadhana until one day she decided she didn't like it, and then we called her Saraswati after that. But I knew her as Sadhana. She, even up until her late 70s, would go to India and stay in these Buddhist monasteries, 16,000 feet high, a very bold woman. Her favorite text was Ashtavakra Samhita, a very uncompromising, non-dualistic text. And she asked me one day, which was based on her reading, she said, if we're already free, then why do we have to strive to become free? Now, it is a very good question, a very logical question. There's a flaw to it. It sounds too good. And we know deep down that there's a problem with it. But it's true. We shouldn't have to strive for something if we already have it. We shouldn't have to look for something if we possess it. But this is the odd part about spiritual life. We are trying to realize something that's already there, to find something which we already have. So I thought about that and thought that rather than just give her a quick answer, that I would turn it into a talk. So that was the story behind today's talk. This question, if we're already perfect, why do we strive for perfection? If we're already one with the Brahman, why don't we realize it, if that's our true nature? Why are we in this state of not knowing who we really are? So I entitle this Remembering Who We Are. This line of reasoning is something which we find in this Ashtavakra Samhita. There's one line that says, Idam eva tu te bandha samadhim anudishtati. This, even to strive for samadhi, is a sign of bondage, because it's our way of telling ourselves that I need to realize something that I don't have. So even to strive for that, so this is where this idea came from. Why should we strive for anything? Why should we practice meditation, do anything, if we're already perfect? This other famous line from the Ashtavakra Samhita is this Muktabhimani Muktohi Badho Badhavimanyapi, that If we feel that we're bound, that means we're bound. There's no other bondage than this false idea that we're bound. Once we realize that we're free and understand it, then we're free. So we do have this line of reasoning, which says simply assert your freedom. That's our true nature. Why should we even consider the thought that we need to do something to make ourselves free? We have this idea, Swamiji says, each soul is potentially divine. He said, no, why potentially divine? Already divine. So we have this way of thinking. But as I said, there's a slight flaw to all of this. And that is that this intellectual understanding that we're already free is not quite the same as the real realization, that real breakthrough. And I saw that one of the ways that we can look at this is not simply that we're covered by a veil of ignorance, or that we have not yet had that breakthrough, but to look at it in terms of a type of amnesia. Sometimes we think, well, we're hypnotized to not see things, or we're covered by Maya, but it's a type of forgetfulness. Now, the reason why I like this idea of amnesia is that amnesia implies that we once had that knowledge, that I used to know who I was, but I forgot. So it has both this idea that it's something that's already a given fact, but for some reason I have to rediscover it. So we have to somehow remember who we already are. We've forgotten somehow. We've been fallen under this type of amnesia. So this is the history behind this, that we have to somehow figure out how to pursue this spiritual quest without ever forgetting that at the very end of it, we won't have attained anything that we didn't already have. And this is a theme that recurs throughout the Vedantic literature. There are many beautiful illustrations. Many of them point to this fact that of the foolishness that's involved in trying to find something which we already have, because we assume that we don't have it. One of the examples is the musk deer. There's an actual animal. It's not really a deer. It's a sort of a very tiny little thing. I researched it once. I got curious about it. There's some in Nepal, some in... it's almost becoming extinct. But the mythological story is that this musk deer emits this scent of musk from its navel. Probably not really from its navel, but in Indian tradition, everything comes from the navel. So this deer gets enchanted by the scent of this musk and wants to find the source of it. Doesn't realize that it's coming from itself. So it runs all over the place, and it runs until it's exhausted and dies from exhaustion without ever finding it, because it never realized that it had it within. So we have this illustration to show us the foolishness of trying to find something which we already possess and looking in the wrong place. We have similar stories. The woman who had a beautiful necklace that she wore every day. One day she woke up and went to look in her drawer to find the necklace to put the necklace on, and she couldn't find it. She was in a panic. She ran all around, went to her husband and said, "Who stole my necklace? Where is it? I wear that every day." And he said to her, "Look in the mirror." She looked in the mirror and she was already wearing it. So plenty of stories like this. Thakur tells about the man who was a cigarette smoker. And he woke up in the middle of the night and wanted to have a smoke, and he couldn't find any matches. So he had his lantern next to him, which he had kept lit throughout the night, and took the lantern and went to a neighbor's house and knocked on the door and explained the whole thing. And his neighbor said, "You woke me up for that. You could have used your lantern." He said, "Lantern is, it's not like our light bulb lanterns. It carries actual light." So we have all of these different stories, the point of which is to tell us that we carry that truth within ourselves, that if we're foolish and we search for it outside of ourselves, then we won't find it, or we'll need someone to tell us. We'll need someone to say, look in the mirror. We'll need someone to say, look down at what you're holding in your hand. Look what's hanging around your neck. So then that'll turn our minds inward, and we'll have some type of realization, some type of awakening. We'll get rid of this amnesia feeling a little bit. Now, there's a story that I want to tell. I don't know where it's from. We have one monk in Southern California. His name is Swami Vedarupananda. He's a great storyteller. He even took some course in storytelling. And he told this story. Of course, he turned it into a 45-minute story. I won't make it such a long story. Could be some Puranic story, or it could be something else. But it's a very nice story. It's about a king who used to like to go hunting. And when he went hunting, of course, he would take off his robe, royal robes and everything, and dress like an ordinary hunter, and take his bow and arrow and go on horseback. And he would go by himself. So one day he went out hunting, and as he was about to shoot some animal, the horse reared back and he fell off and he hit his head, and he fell down unconscious. Then the next morning he woke up, came back to consciousness, but couldn't remember anything. He didn't remember the kingdom, his queen, his sons and daughters. He didn't remember anything. He didn't know who he was. But he looked down and he saw there was a bow and arrow. He saw that he was dressed like a hunter, and he assumed that he was a hunter. He had nothing else to do. And he didn't know where he was. He's in the middle of the woods in this forest. So he somehow made a little hut and lived through hunting and stayed in that forest for a long time, not knowing that he was the king. Then, one by one, different people would come by. And he would always ask them, because he used to have a dream. He had this recurring dream that he was a king. He used to dream that he had a kingdom, and he had his servants, and he had his ministers, and everyone obeyed him. It was a very interesting dream, but it was a disturbing dream. He'd wake up from it and think, why did I have that dream? And something seemed a little familiar to him, but still, he thought, I'm a hunter. Why did I have this dream? So different people would come, and he would ask them, can you explain this dream to me? So all the different people, they gave their own different interpretations. But one day a holy man came, and this holy man recognized him as the king. And he said that you had that dream because you really are the king. And you must have hit your head for something like that. And he said, no, it's only a dream, because he had this amnesia. He didn't remember any of that. So this holy man was a very wise man. He said to him, well, maybe you're really not the king, but there's a kingdom very nearby. They lost their king. Somehow he went out one day, he never came back. So they need a king, and you look a little bit like him. I'm sure if you went there and you said, I'm the king, you told everybody I'm the king, they would accept you as the king. And to convince yourself, you should also tell yourself, I am the king, I am the king, I am the king, like a method actor. So you'll start thinking, well, yes, I'm the king, and then you'll have a nice life and everything. So he said, okay, I'll give it a try. He went to this kingdom, and everyone, he went up to them and said, I am the king. They said, oh, your highness, we're so happy to have you back, because they all recognized him. He was the king. And gradually, repeating, I am the king, I am the king, he saw the ministers, and it started getting a little clearer, and he saw his children, and then he saw his wife, and then something clicked. Oh, I am the king. So this amnesia that he had was broken somehow, and he realized that he was that very thing he was trying to tell himself that he was. and that he hadn't fooled anyone and occupied a position as king that wasn't his. He really was the king. Now, the importance of this story or this parable is that this failure to recognize our true nature is a type of amnesia, because we have to feel that on some level we have to remember it again. On some level, once we have that realization, we'll say, yes, I knew it all along. I had simply forgotten. We won't feel that we've attained something that wasn't our very own possession. This is one of the important aspects of this. And in the case of amnesia, it's not simply enough to be told this truth. Someone can come up to us and say, yes, you are Brahman. We'll say, okay, thank you. This is very nice. It won't do any good. Someone who has amnesia, we can go to them and say, no, this is your name. This is where you live. We can show them a photograph with a driver's license, with ID. Until that breaks, that amnesia, it won't do any good. It may help a little bit, but something has to happen. With the help of others, of course, they may point out to us this and that, but something has to happen to break that. So there is some radical breakthrough which is involved, even in remembering something which we never lost, attaining something which we never lost, remembering who we are. Now, the other important element is this dream, because even in the midst of our forgetfulness, the midst of this amnesia, there's some nagging doubt in the back of the mind that who we think we are now isn't real. That's very important. If we want to discover who we really are, we have to have some feeling that we've forgotten. Some feeling that this isn't right. That, as Swamiji sang in the song, that we're strangers in a strange garb, traveling in a strange world, in a strange land, and that we have our home someplace else that we'd really like to get back to. We don't know much about it. So that aspect is very important. This shows up in the dream. It was always within that consciousness, beneath the surface, that this man was the king. Now, if we assume that we're all suffering from this amnesia, then how do we regain the memory of our real divine nature as one with the Brahman, as eternal, as unborn, as perfect, as transcendent? How do we retain that? Now, it's an interesting question, partly because this idea of remembering and amnesia and memory, all of this is very interesting. In fact, we use this term, remember, to remember, in two very, very different senses. If we think about it, the way we use the term remember, sometimes we use it with regard to something that we've forgotten. We try to remember something. We try to recall it. We try to bring it back into consciousness. We're starting out with some blank, and we're trying to fill that blank. The other is something that we know and we don't want to forget. So in the first case, we can say that try to remember what you said yesterday. We'll say that to somebody. And the other one will say, don't forget what you said yesterday. So always remember to eat your vegetables. That's something. So we want to keep it in our mind, conscious mind, all of the time. But the other is, we've really forgotten something. I wish I could remember that person's name. It's very embarrassing. Every time I see that person, I have to hem and haw, and I don't remember that person. So we use the term really in two very different ways. In fact, the title of this talk was purposely ambiguous, because it means both that we're trying to remember who we are in the sense that we've forgotten it, and we're trying to remember who we are. We're trying to practice constant recollection of our divine nature, which we'll find out is one of the means of doing it. Just as the king practiced that, I am the king, I am the king, I am the king. He was remembering that he was the king, even though he didn't know it at that time. So this is this trying to remember, it brings up a little bit of an existential problem, because we're trying to bring into consciousness something which is empty, which is not there. And we all know how frustrating it is to try to remember something which we've forgotten. Right? How do we do it? We have to kind of encircle, you know, you circle the troops. We can't make a direct attack. We have to just kind of get closer and closer. What do? We've lost our keys. Well, retrace our steps. Where was I in the morning? Did I drive to this place? Could I have left it there? Because we've forgotten it. We can't just bring it back. We can't remember somebody's name. We go through the alphabet. Did it begin with an A, a B, a C? And we hope that if the name is Charlie, we get to C, and then we say, oh, Charlie. But we can't make ourselves remember something which we've forgotten, because it's not there. It's an absence. We're trying to focus. That's why we say, oh, I drew a blank. Sometimes the best way to, if we want to really understand how the mind can have nothingness as its object, try to remember something you've forgotten. Just for that second, blank. The mind goes blank, right? So here we're trying to draw back into consciousness something which we don't know how to access. So this is part of this existential dilemma. Now, we usually need some clues, some way to trace things back. As I was saying with, we've lost our keys, then at least we know where we were 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago. We remember the last time we had them. We can work around it a little bit. Now, when it comes to this knowledge of our real self, we also have a few little clues. We have a few little clues, just as this king had the dream that he had. We also have these clues that come in very subtle ways. There are times when we get very quiet and we feel some sense of transcendence. We feel some sense of otherness, some sense of alienation in this world. All of these are little signs to us that we are something different, that what we see isn't the whole of everything. And we also have this dream experience. I'll get to that dream experience. Not like the king's dream, but the very fact of the dream points to an aspect of ourselves which transcends even this waking state that we have. One of the best aids that we have in this task of trying to remember who we are is the spiritual teacher. Swamiji tells the story, Sri Ramakrishna also told the story, of the lion and the sheep. Sometimes it's a tiger and a goat. It was the same story, that this lioness was going out hunting, and she saw some sheep, and she went to attack. This lioness was ready to give birth, and as the lioness leaped, then gave birth to a baby cub and died. So this baby cub was there, the other sheep were there, and they took pity on the cub and they raised this cub as their very own. And this little cub learned to baa like the other sheep, and to eat grass like the other sheep, and live just like the other sheep, and thought that it was just the same as the other sheep, didn't know any different. Now one day another lion came and saw this grass-eating sheep bleeding a cub, tiger cub, and said, what is this? And ran and caught this tiger cub and said, what is this? Why are you bleeding like a baby, like a lamb, and eating grass and everything? And the cub thought it was a sheep, didn't know what to do. And the lion said, come with me. And he took the lion, baby lion, to a pool, pond was there, and said, look at your reflection there, and then look at my reflection. And then he said, Amioja tuyota. You are the very same thing that I am. And he looked and he saw, yes, I see the reflection and I see that, so I must also look like that. And then and Guru, this tiger stands for the Guru, this tiger said, now give up all of this grass eating and bleeding and everything and gave him a piece of meat. Now, you eat this meat, you're a lion and or a tiger, whatever. And this baby lamb got the taste of the blood and looked and let out a big roar and went off and knew that he was never a sheep, but from the very beginning was a tiger. Not that any transformation took place, but through the help of the Guru and the teachings, realized his own true nature. Now, the other way I was reading through this talk last night, and it's all there's five sheaths and everything. I swore that I wouldn't bore anyone again with the five sheaths. We had it with the retreat and too many times. But one of the other ways that we have a clue for us, which is very interesting, is the phenomenon of memory itself. If we analyze, because what are we trying to do? We're trying to find out who this real I is, who the real self is. One of the ways of doing it is by analyzing how memory works and how memory works with regard to our sense of self-identification. Who am I? This question. Now, if we look at this sense of self that we have, we find that we feel some thread of identity that goes from at least our very birth to the present. Right? We all feel I'm the same person. Now, that doesn't mean that I haven't changed and I haven't learned things and grown this and that, but I never confuse myself with somebody else. I don't think that I was Swami M when I was young and now that I'm Swami A. I know that I was, there's some thread that goes through that we can't jump and switch. Even though we may say there's only one self in all, our sense of identification stays in that one body, even as that one body changes, and through the mind, even as that changes. Now, what is this thread that goes through all of it? In a sense, it's memory. Because we don't have any break in that memory where we lost the thread here and we picked it up someplace else. We have unbroken memory. There may be little breaks, but more or less, of who we were from the time that we're little children. That's the whole reason why we can see that we did change. And what is the real source of that? It's not the mind, it's not the little memories and everything. It's the fact that this witnessing consciousness has been there throughout the whole process, which itself doesn't change. If the witness changes, we won't have any unchanging background on which to see other change. If there's not something within us that doesn't change, we won't even have an awareness of change. We need that stable factor. And we need something which doesn't contribute to anything. This witnessing consciousness is not responsible for our change of attitude, for our maturing process or anything. It is simply there as this light of consciousness, which is behind everything and which is silently watching everything. We see this also in the three states of consciousness, that we can even feel that same sense of I in the dream body. Now, we know when we wake up that it wasn't a case of some self within jumping out of the sleeping body and somehow entering into some dream body that goes some other place. It's consciousness. And it's that consciousness which accounts for our sense of I in the waking state, our sense of I in the dream state as well. So Through this type of analysis, which we learn from the scriptures and which we learn from the gurus and everything, we also can get some type of conviction. Two types of conviction. The one was we're seeing things a little bit wrongly. And the second one is, oh, this is the real nature of the self. The real nature of the self is transcendent. It doesn't change. My sense of I doesn't change. Even as this body grows, as this mind changes, or even as this body disappears when I fall asleep, and when I seem to enter into another body in that dream state. So we get this sense through this practice of analysis that we're something transcendent, that we're something immortal, something unchanging. In the waking state, we can practice this discrimination, this drig drishya viveka, this discrimination between the seer and the seen. This is one of the very important spiritual disciplines in the path of Advaita Vedanta, that we constantly try to separate the subject from the object. In our normal way of thinking, we think of the subject as I. That means the ego. In this Vedantic type of thinking, anything that can be an object of consciousness becomes the subject automatically. So this ego, if I can talk about it, if I can imagine it, if I can picture it, if I can say it's too big, it's too little, it's too secure, it's too insecure, it's an object. It's an idea. It's not the real I. The real I is that which is observing, which is calm, quiet. It's the bird at the top of the tree and not the bird jumping around eating the different fruits in Swamiji's parable from the Mundaka Upanishad. So we, through this type of analysis, we get this conviction that this real I depends on nothing but consciousness. It doesn't depend even on the mind. The mind is responsible for the empirical ego, for that I, which is the apparent self. But the real self, the only thing it depends on is that consciousness, which is what it really is and what we really are. There's oneness with Atman and Brahman. Now, this doesn't give us that breakthrough necessarily, but it gives us this main clue so that we have that conviction and we go on with our spiritual practice, because there's no way to get around this spiritual practice business. Even if our spiritual practice is constant remembrance and this constant type of discrimination. Now, I want to go back to this idea of realization, why we talk about realization as a kind of remembering. Now, I already tried to emphasize this idea that there's some deja vu factor involved here, that there's some feeling that we've done this before, that we get a little glimpse of something and it seems familiar. Even for a moment, the mind gets a little bit quiet, or we withdraw a little bit, and there's some feeling of familiarity to that, because it's our real nature. It's a very logical thing. We have done it before. This is where we come from. This is our real self. So, how do we account for this feeling of familiarity? Now, one is, of course, that we always have a sense of ourselves as the witness. That never leaves us. Whenever we do anything, we have this awareness of knownness, this I know. We have that awareness. We feel that it's behind us somehow. We don't always identify the self with that. But this is so strong that it leads from one point of view, we can say it forms the whole foundation for this idea of God. It gets projected outward, not simply behind us, but in the heavens somewhere. This sense and this experience that we have, that every thought we have is known. we project it outward and we say, well, God hears all of our thoughts. Or we take this Advaitic point of view and say, I am the knower. That's my real nature. So it's something that we're all familiar with. Swamiji says that the self is the most known of all things. We're more prone to say that this Atman and Brahman, unknown and unknowable. They're unknown and unknowable because they can't be objects of knowledge. But it's the most known thing. There's not a single one of us who doesn't know that we exist. Right? And we don't exist the way a table exists. You remove this consciousness from us, we won't say we exist. Our existence is to be conscious beings. So this is one thing. And the other is that, and this is my own theory, I think there's a vague memory of that period in our lives before the formation of this ego. You know, there are many people in spiritual life or just who are interested in psychology that long to go back to this pristine state of infancy, where somehow, or even this security of the state of being in the womb, some people feel, before this ego comes, before this Maya, this veil of Maya comes, that somehow we're living in a state of oneness with things. That this sense of separation comes as this ego develops. Psychologically, the ego develops, and we feel that we're separate from everyone and everything. So there's some sense of memory, I think, which we all have of a time in our lives when, of course, we couldn't think everything through rationally, but we had that experience of oneness, where we didn't feel ourselves to be different or distinct from anything else. Now, the other thing, and to me, this is the most interesting of all the clues, is this dream state. If we want to really break this strong sense of identification with this body, with this mind, with this world, all we have to do is think about what happens every night when we have a dream. What happens? This universe disappears. This body disappears. I'm told from the standpoint of experience. It may be there, of course, for someone else to see, but from my point of view, the body disappears. And what happens? A whole universe appears out of nothing. A new body appears out of nothing. And I go about my business as if everything is perfectly real, 100% real. We, in a dream, it never occurs to us to think that this is just a projection of my mind or this is somehow Maya at work. We don't think that. It seems every bit as real as this waking state seems to be real. Then what happens when we wake up? We dismiss it. We don't think about it. Oh, it was just a dream. Now, this is the greatest clue. We shouldn't say it was just a dream. We should say, oh my goodness, how is it possible that I was so identified with that body in the dream, 100% sure that I was that body, 100% sure that the whole world was real, and now I'm going to simply say, oh, forget it. We should think that how is it possible that this world and this body are any more real, or that I have any stronger reason to believe that there's some absolute reality to this body, to this world, to this sense of identification than I had in the dream state. So to me, and I always say this, that if God created this world and he created this nasty game for us to try to put us in bondage so that we can get out of bondage, that he needed to be nice enough to give us one clue, and he said, all right, I'll let them dream. That'll be their one clue. And see if they're smart enough to learn anything from this dream and to question the reality of this waking state by seeing the reality of the dream state disappear like that. So this is the other thing that I think is very important. Now, I want to go back because we're still left to this question of how do we do this remembering? We're convinced of all of this. We're all brilliant people. We all understand, no, this is not ultimately real. I'm something else. And yet we remain the same fools that we always were. We don't have that breakthrough like the king. The big difference between the king pretending he's king and then waking up and saying, oh yeah, no, I really am the king. Now I remember. For some people, it is a very easy thing. We look at one of the greatest examples of is Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi, simply one day he got some funny idea in his mind that perhaps death could come at any moment. Then what does it mean for the body to die? And he thought, let me see. And he laid himself down on the floor in the room where he was staying, his uncle's house. And he imagined the body going cold. He imagined the senses shutting down, this and that. And had the full understanding that I do not die. I'm something different from the body. He awoke. That was it. That was his enlightenment. Of course, he did very intense austerities after that also. Like we saw with the direct disciples, just to make that his very own experience. But that was it. The bonds of Maya were broken. So these are rare cases. In the Upanishads, the tradition was that the disciple would spend many years doing different types of disciplines. And half of these disciplines were keeping the sacred fire and tending the cows for the guru and doing all sorts of things. In addition to the meditation and the scriptural study and everything, but when the time was right, all they needed was tattvamasi. You are that. And then, I am that. Done. So this is the case for those who are really ripe, perfectly ripe for that. Now, what about the rest of us? The ones who hear all of this, yes, you're a tiger, and our answer is, bah. See, we hear it, we may even believe it on some level, but we're so convinced that it's not really true, or we're so used to this identification, this other type of identification. What do we do? Now, there's an irony here, and this is something I pointed to before. We pretend. We don't really know that we're the king, but the holy man said, tell yourself over and over again, I am the king, I am the king, I am the king. We do that. This is called aropa. This is what Sri Ramakrishna used to say. Adopt that attitude. If it's really true, and if we keep telling ourselves, it's not that we'll hypnotize ourselves, we'll have a breakthrough and realize that it's true. So it wasn't that the king was trying to hypnotize, he was already hypnotized. He was already under the state of amnesia. He was trying to remember. This is one of the things that Swami Vivekananda stressed most. This idea of affirmation, this idea of repeatedly telling ourselves over and over again something which is really true. Not that we're trying to convince ourselves of something that's not true, or trying to change ourselves into something which we aren't already, but trying to get us to realize what we already are. There's a very beautiful quotation from Swamiji. This is the only way to reach the goal, to tell ourselves and to tell everybody else that we are divine. And as we go on repeating this, strength comes. He who falters at first will get stronger and stronger, and the voice will increase by volume until the truth takes possession of our hearts and courses through our veins and permeates our bodies. Say to your own minds, I am he, I am he. Let it ring day and night in your minds like a song. And at the point of death declare, I am he. That is the truth. The infinite strength of the world is yours. So this is the practice. In addition to our meditation and everything else, this affirmation, this constant remembrance, remembering who we are in the second sense, remembering at least what we're told, remembering to remind ourselves that, yes, I am that. I am one with the Brahman. I am not this puny little self that will come and go and suffer all this humility of pain and anguish and depression and all of these other things. I am that infinite Brahman. Telling ourselves over and over again until we have that realization. And once we have that realization, we'll say, ah, I knew it all along. I had simply forgotten it. I was always that from the very beginning. Even when I felt that I was in this state of ignorance, I was that. And now I know it as a type of remembering. And when we have that experience, God willing, we'll all have that feeling that, yes, I've been perfect for all eternity. This is not some new transformation. This is simply I'm remembering who I really was. So let us stop here. We have a few minutes. I think it'll be nice for us to sit quietly and try to feel that the real self within is that very small, quiet ocean of tranquility that's not at all involved with this mind that's jumping about, but is ever peaceful, ever calm, not affected by anything, which is eternal, transcendent, and one with this Supreme Brahman, one with all other selves, that one reality.
Asado ma sarvamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma mratam gamaya, avirabhir mayeti, rudriyate dakshanam mukham, tenamam pahi nityam. Om shanti shanti shanti, hari om tatsat.
Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all.
Let me add one little thing to the talk. This idea of grace. We sometimes wonder, we associate it, of course, with more devotional practices. We sometimes wonder why it's such an important aspect of spiritual life. Even here, we see that we can't make ourselves remember something because it's a negative. It's something not there. We can't put our hands on something which we can't find. We prepare everything. We try to get the mind in the proper state, but it just emerges. Sometimes we don't know why, we'll remember something. Because the mind gets in the proper state. So we call it grace. It's never through our self-effort. Our self-effort prepares us, gets it everything ready, but that reality itself emerges. It pulls us in. It attracts us somehow. So even here, we see the importance of this idea of grace.